Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cesternino here, and we've got some great Survivor off-season coverage for you. A little bit different than some of the recent postseason interviews that we've done. We're going to be talking with a guy who goes by the name of Peridium, and he's got a YouTube channel, and he talks about Survivor, mostly Big Brother, Amazing Race as well. And he creates these videos talking about all sorts of different Survivor subjects, the kind of things that we would talk about in a long format in a podcast. He does some really great Survivor videos. He's been working on a series about the most ingenious moves made by Survivor winners. No reason in particular that he is looking at that type of thing. And what he's done is he's gone back and looked at some really unique moves that were made by different Survivor winners. He's posted parts 1, 2, and 3 on his YouTube channel. We're going to talk about the 10 moves that he has posted in part 3 here today, but I highly recommend you check out parts 1 and 2 on his YouTube channel. That is Peridium. Of course, we've got a lot of other Survivor podcasts here in terms of our exit interviews or postseason retrospectives from the season. I've just posted our interviews with Aurora and Reem this week, in addition to all the other interviews that we've done in the postseason. So be on the lookout for those as well if you missed any of them. Before we get to talking with Peridium, I want to take a moment and thank one of our sponsors, and those are our friends over at DC Universe. That's the first all DC platform for DC fans, where you can watch, read, shop, and even connect with other fans. That's the home of the original DC series like Titans, Doom Patrol, Swamp Thing, and coming soon, Harley Quinn featuring Kaley Cuoco. Thousands of new comics have just been added to their comic library, including more complete storylines and more recent titles like Batman 2011, Superman, Secret Origin, and Harley Quinn 2013. New animated films like Reign of the Superman and Justice League versus Fatal Five. Catch up on series including Krypton Season 1, or find tons of classic movies like Batman, Batman Returns, or Superman. DC Universe is available on your favorite devices. Join today and get a year's worth of content at dcuniverse.com. All right, everybody, I'm very excited to bring in our guest for today's podcast. This has been one that has been a long time in the making. I have been a long time fan of this content creator who has been killing it on YouTube with videos about mostly the Survivor, Big Brother, Amazing Race, the CBS Holy Trinity. Here he is to talk about some of the most ingenious moves made by Survivor winners, the great Peridium. Peridium, how are you?
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Peridium, and we are on Rob as a Podcast. Rob, thank you for having me on.
I'm very excited to have made contact with you. I know you were on the B&B a while back, but you and I had been emailing for a bit, trying to figure out something to do, and I'm really glad that we were able to get on the same page to talk about some of these winner moves.
I know. It's been a long time in the making ever since we first made contact, and I was hoping it wouldn't slip through my fingers at some point, or something crazy would happen with my channel between now and then. And but now with the off season, you know, going on, and we're sort of in the cracks of Survivor and Big Brother, I'm just like, this is the perfect opportunity, and I'm really glad to be here.
But let's set up a little bit about what you do for anybody that doesn't know about your channel, about your videos. And what you do is that you create, you know, really slick, high-end videos that are often, you know, like a list or examining like a specific topic or moment in the history of these shows. It's fair to say that you do the most on Survivor, right?
Yeah, it is. I appreciate the compliment calling them really slick and high-end.
Like most other people in this space. It's like, okay, it's a Google Hangout between two people talking about the thing.
Right.
And you're actually going in and you've got the highlights and you're showing us exactly what happened.
Right. So when I was seeking out to start the channel initially, it was simply because I'm interested in these kinds of videos for other things that I'm invested in outside of Survivor that I know exist on YouTube. And I was like, oh, it'd be cool if kind of channel that I was envisioning, which I started, would be on YouTube. And it wasn't. It was mostly it's podcasts or you get long form interviews and stuff like that, which are also great. Mm-hmm. And I've been listening to for the past decade of my life now. But I was like, you know, I wonder if there's something that could exist that like I was envisioning. And it turns out, I guess, at the moment there is. So here we are.
Yeah. And it's really great. I've been watching the channel for a long time that you do these great videos. I'd say, what's the average runtime about? Like 15 minutes on these?
I usually go for about 15 minutes. I try to aim for 15, no longer than 20. But in the case of some videos like the one that we're going to be talking about today, this is probably going to be the longest video I will have made thus far. Mm-hmm. I haven't finished it even as we're recording this, but it's probably like I have an hour's worth of audio that I'm sifting through of me talking because I write a script out first when I'm making the video. I brainstorm the idea, then I'll do a lot of research. I will watch episodes back and all that to make sure that I have, you know, facts and details correct because I don't want to say something that's not right. I don't always get it right, but you know, for the most part, I want to make sure that I know what I'm talking about. And then I will write the script and record myself. And normally I would say that I have about 30 minutes of unedited audio that I will condense down into about 10 to 15 at most. But in this case, this is a huge video that I put together, particularly because I wanted to celebrate the fact that I'm on Rob as a podcast. And it's at least at the moment I have an hour of unedited footage, which is twice as long. So it's going to be a long video.
So you start with the audio, you start with the script, you record that, and then you edit the video on top of the audio track.
Yeah, so I'll record myself reading my script out. I obviously do a little bit of improvisation here and there, and then I will edit that audio down with, I will have a lot of like a Rolodex of different episode clips in mind that I know I want to probably include mm-hmm. in the video. And as I'm editing the audio, I will sort of leave gaps in the audio file that I know I want to insert a clip of Richard Hatch doing this or whatever. And I'll have a general idea of at least what I'm looking for. So I'll know that. And then I'll have a general idea of how long the video is going to be. And if I need to maybe slim it down a little because it's going a little too long or it's like that, like, and then I'll edit the video on top of it. So that's the general process.
And when did you start the channel?
I started the channel in the middle of Heroes, Healers, and Hustlers, which was October mm-hmm. of 2017. And I had an idea for it going months back in between Game Changers and season 35 during that summertime, which I think was Big Brother 18, maybe? Or was it? No, it was 19. Mm-hmm. I just started putting the pieces together, gathering the resources that I thought I would need that would make it easier for me to... really, when I started, I wanted to have a consistent upload schedule. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to be sporadic. I just knew that personally, I always enjoyed it when content creators or whoever was making things on a regular basis, you, like yourself included. So I just gathered all the resources that summer. And then I just started crafting this this routine that I have somehow managed to stick to for almost 2 years coming up this October, which really is crazy to think about now that it was just a little fun little hobby on the side. I'm a huge Survivor and Big Brother fan. And yeah, I just took some skills together, managed to push a little bit of my other hobbies to the side, and all of a sudden this has just taken center stage, and it's been a blast, really, for the last year and a half, last year and three quarters. I've had nothing but enjoyment on a weekly basis, so I'm just hoping that it can stay this way for who knows how long.
And your name, Pridium, what does that mean? Can you give us the origin story on that?
Yeah, so... growing up, I had like a really lame kiddie email address that I created a long time ago, and it was just it didn't make any sense. And I was like, I can't use that. Like, it was like a backup email that I would use. So like a couple of years back, before I started the channel, I was thinking up of a new online name for, because I'm a video game player, and I was thinking about a new name for my Xbox. And obviously, I'm not going to use my real name, so I just started thinking about stuff in my real life that I could somehow combine into something sentimental that nobody else would know about. And it ended up combining it into, it was my wife's birthstone and my birthstone, which is pretty not, I know you don't like how when Survivor tribes combine their merged name.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. Name.
Yeah, so I decided to go with that. And I combined the birthstone, which was Peridot and Diamond. So it's Paradium mm-hmm. or Paradigm, which is also a part of it. This is a minor little Easter egg, but When you look at like the name Peridium that I use for my Twitter and the YouTube channel, it's got white and green. That's the color pattern because it's supposed to be emblematic of diamond and peridot, which is green. So like I have a queen chess piece with a green survivor buff, which is sort of just the diamond, which is the diamond part of it, and the peridot, the green. So little tiny things in the background.
Okay.
But that's what it means. It's doesn't actually mean anything else. It's just a random word.
Okay. So we're going to talk about the half of your list. It's part three in the video, and it has just dropped on your YouTube channel. You had dropped part one and part two, which each had five moves in those videos. We're going to talk about the 10 moves that you're covering in part three. Of course, people can go back and watch part one and part two of the series on your YouTube channel at youtube.com/Peridium. Is that the right link to give out?
I believe it is. I'd have to double check, but I'm pretty sure.
You gotta go on YouTube. It's not easy to find things on YouTube. Okay, go on YouTube, search Peridium. You're gonna get there.
If you spell it wrong, it's okay. For all my videos, I always do the tags in the background. I always do spelling errors because I know my name is off. It's offbeat. Mm-hmm. Nobody really knows how to spell it. So
yeah,
if you spell it wrong, you'll find it.
Okay, so we are going to talk through the 10 moves that are covered in part three of your series. And what I like that you've done here is that you are not necessarily ranking moves of like, these are the greatest moves of all time by any stretch of the imagination, but these are in your total list. These are 20 sort of original, unique moves that were made by people who have won the game.
Yeah. So when I was thinking up the idea, a lot of people like me to rank stuff and try and subjectively like measure them and which one was the better or the worst. And I understand the appeal on that. But for this list, I was thinking more of just sort of collecting a list of moves that I found to be sort of people, players, winners, thinking outside of the box, the usual beyond like simply flipping or, blindsiding or playing an idol correctly. Like those are a dime a dozen. We get those a lot. And you know, it's cool when they happen, but I was thinking maybe something a little bit more original, something we had never seen before, or something that required a little bit more just outside of the box thinking, creative. And so basically I was, as I said in part one, these are just synonyms for the word ingenious, not to be confused with the word genius, which actually I was initially confused by too. I was like, oh yeah, brilliant moves. So they're not really necessarily always brilliant. And I sort of was trying to wrap my head around this and not be too, bogged down in the semantics of the word and the definition, because I didn't want it to be like a debate of, or what is this really ingenious or not, and more just appreciating the move itself. Mm-hmm. But these aren't necessarily always going to be moves that are necessarily fantastic. They are not always going to be the best moves ever made by winners or by any player. I mean, there are a lot of players who didn't win who made better moves than the 20 moves I've listed here. But I was looking for moves that just sort of required an extra element to them that you don't usually see, or they're the first of their kind in this case.
Right. And in some cases, I think that you would dare even say that they are game-changing moves.
We may end up seeing a game changer on this list at least once.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's take it away. So these are 10 moves, no particular order, even with part one and part two.
Yes.
Those are not the bottom 10 and those are not the top 10. It's just we're talking 20 moves altogether.
Part one and part two each had five moves listed in them. And then this is part three. It'll have 10 moves. There is no particular order. Well, technically, that's not true. There is a particular order, and the order is whatever I thought would be the most interesting to talk to you with. So
okay.
I took right. 10 in part one and part two, and I thought these would be good. And I do systematically try and make it so that there's a sort of an order to them. And if people are trying to read between the lines, figuring out the order, you could figure it out. But for the most part, yes, there is no order. This is not, number one is not the first one we talk about and vice versa. So,
yes.
And I wanted to set this up really quickly and just say that I know you don't know what I'm going to be bringing up.
Right.
And I was wondering if before I get to the move, I was going to ask you if you could try and guess based on the winner and obviously the season that they were in, see if you could figure out what move I'm thinking of.
Fun. Okay. Yeah. And yes. I certainly would have done the prep. The video isn't up yet. We're recording this before the video has dropped. Yeah. I don't want people to think, boy, Rob couldn't even watch the YouTube video before he talked to the guy who made them.
Yeah, but you did watch part one and part two.
I did watch part one and part two.
You do have an idea of what's in part one and part two.
Yes.
And there are a handful of winners. And we will see repeats of winners who have made more than one move. In the case of part one and part two, we saw Tony come up twice. He showed up in part one and part two. He may or not part show up in part three today. But yeah. Anyway.
Not enough Tony for me. Should have had all 10.
He's honestly, I was going through the moves off the top of my head. And then I was looking at the whole list of everyone. I was like, you know, Tony's got a handful of select individual things he did that were pretty crafty. But, you know, maybe we'll see if we get to him or not.
Yeah. Yes. The pre-merge going to the other camp, I feel like that was something that I had forgotten about that he did. And that was very, very crafty, very clever. So it was,
I know. I love that. It's a small little moment. Didn't have much of an impact on the overall season. But for the episode, it was a fun little storyline that Tony did that I always remembered in the back of my mind. And I finally was like, yeah, I can finally talk about it.
Okay. All right. Where are we going first?
So I figured it was only fitting to start at the very top with the very first season, of course, Survivor Borneo, and we have Richard Hatch, the winner. Now, there aren't a ton of moves to be talking about in the first place with Borneo, let alone by one player. But for the most part, you know, we have Richard Hatch, who was really ingenious. If you could guess one move Richard Hatch pulled off that I would think would be ingenious, what would you say? If you had to look at Richard Hatch's full game from episode one until the finale, and
one couple of things. And he's first, so everything he did is original and
right.
Unique.
That's another thing.
So I would start with taking his hand off the pole and removing himself from winning the final three immunity.
And if I had a bell, I would ring it because that's correct. I was surprised because there's a lot of stuff that Richard did that you could technically define as ingenious, given he was a part of one of the original alliances. Obviously, a lot of the blindsides. I don't know exactly who was like responsible for some of that stuff. We didn't have a ton of the strategic footage, but for 100% fact, we did see Richard Hatch at the final three of Survivor Borneo, who intentionally takes his hand off of that heart idol. And he throws the first ever final three immunity challenge, basically to increase his odds of winning the season. And I'm curious, obviously, to get your take on these moves and what you think about them. But I'll say from my perspective, obviously, this was a shoo-in for the list. I don't know if I've talked about it too much in previous videos, but for me, I found it ingenious because it took an approach that you don't really see ever in Survivor. Throwing challenges. You don't see it very often. I think you see a little bit more in Big Brother. And he did it in the first season, which obviously it's going to have a strange stigma to it because there's less strategy in the first place. And he did it purely for strategical reasons, of course. He threw the challenge. He didn't just fall off unintentionally or give up. I mean, he sort of gave up, but he gave up tactically. And I was looking it up and I came across this, I'm not a mathematician, but I came across this term and I was reminded partially thanks to Jeff Probst at the reunion show of Survivor Thailand. I don't know if you remember this or not, but he brought up this reference to a dissertation written by John Nash.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen this or not, but I was really intrigued by this because somebody had mentioned this and I looked it up and it's basically the Nash equilibrium. And it became relevant to Richard Hatch's case. Now, I don't know if he knew about it or if he knew what he was doing, but it was essentially he knew that his best move was to throw the challenge because the best moves of the other players were not going to change. Like Kelly had to eliminate Rudy. Rudy had to win the challenge, and they were both taking Rich to the final two either way. Rich then realized, well, I'm going to the final two, so I don't want to burn Rudy because I have to vote out Rudy, and Kelly's going to take me. And if it's Kelly and I in the finals and in the final two of the immunity challenge with Rudy falling first, if he intentionally throws it at that point, it's going to look pretty bad in Rudy's eyes. So he was trying to save a jury vote, which ended up getting him the game. Anyway, I'm getting way ahead of myself. I was just curious, what did you think about this?
Well, it's an incredible move and an incredible move for television, because that it's such a historic television show, that episode where over 50 million people are watching live, and you know, there's so much invested in people really rooting for Rudy, and a lot of people like Kelly, and Richard has been the, you know, painted as the villain of the season, and you know, there's this this huge tent, we've never seen this play out before, and then to have Richard take his hand off of the post, but then to sort of sit there, and I'll never forget this, that Jeff Probst tried to tempt people to come down with orange slices. He's like, yeah. Oh, take a look at these orange slices.
Oh, the aroma, yeah. Just
like, Kelly, wouldn't you like to have a piece of this orange? And like, well, I'm kind of like playing for $1 million right now. And so, but then Richard is like, he's like sitting there and he's eating the oranges and he's just so matter of fact about everything. It's like, you know, and just talking very openly about everybody's position in the game. And the worst case scenario for Richard would have been for him to win that challenge and then
exactly
have to vote out Rudy, because Rudy, who valued loyalty above all else, he was not going to vote for Richard if Richard was the person who took him out. So it was the best case scenario for Richard. Now, I don't believe he could have beaten Kelly if she did not, you know, slip or give up herself. But just to have the awareness to be able to talk about the game, you know, on the, you know, the 39th day, I'm not sure if it was day 30 or 39, but 30, to be able to, you know, talk about the game and understand everything that was happening was incredible.
Yeah, I thought, you know, if you asked me to think of like the top five moments, I would say Richard Hatch sitting there talking about what he just did. I'll always have that ingrained in my mind. Like I use my Rolodex of Survivor clips to go back to and highlight important moments in the show's history. You know, on my YouTube videos, I do that on a weekly basis. And I like just, I just know Richard's speech almost by heart, and just listening to him say it's all a game of odds. You know, I can't guarantee anything will happen, but he's actually being a little bit facetious because he knows that Kelly's best move, her optimal move here, is to win and to cut Rudy in this case. And he knows that Rudy's best move is to win, and he wins $1 million basically to win if he wins the challenge. And so he realizes at this point, like, he's the guy getting taken to the final two to hopefully be beaten. And he realizes that Rudy values loyalty more than anything else. And if he can't be there with Rudy in the end, he can't win the challenge. So he has to do the only thing that's in his best interest, and that is drop out. And it's just, it's great to see him sit down and vocalize that, I think, especially at the time in the history of the show when it was so young and the concept of doing this was just so foreign, I think, to most of us, including Probst himself, who was like, why did you do that? Like, what's going on, man? Like, yeah. You just bowed out at the final three. And now in this case, there's like 50 million people watching it, but he was doing something that was so beyond his time. And I just sort of think, like, even then at the time, I don't even know if it was necessarily beyond his time, because most players don't throw the final challenge. They try to win the final challenge to guarantee their spot in the final three or the final two. So even then, Richard was making a play that I think was above and beyond what you normally would see on any season of the show. It just happened to be the first one.
Rudy had said, at least during that season and again during the All-Stars, that if anybody crossed him, they shouldn't do that because, you know, I got friends, and implying that there was going to be some sort of physical harm to anybody who betrayed Rudy.
And I think what's interesting to note about Rudy in this case was he said his biggest regret, I think this was his final speech at the final tribal council, was how he regretted him falling out of the challenge. It wasn't Richard falling out. He just got up there and he's like, I don't have anything to say. Just want to say I regret not winning it. And it's like, that's fascinating to me, at least on a strategic level for Richard's sake, because he didn't burn Rudy despite the fact that Probst calls Richard out at the challenge and says, you actually just sort of dogged Rudy there. Like, you just left him hanging and now it's all on Rudy's hands to win this for you. Mm-hmm. And Richard's like, whoops. Oh, well, you know, good luck, Rudy. And Rudy still voted for him. And his biggest regret was not like anything that had to do with Richard. It was just he put the weight on Rudy's shoulders. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was another element to Richard's move here that I found just worked out in his favor. It ultimately lends itself to being one of the most ingenious moves. I think it was a shoo-in, too, for the list. Mm-hmm. It would be a crime if I didn't have it in this video. So,
yeah. It's one of my favorite things that we got to talk about when Josh Wigler and I did the evolution of strategy, and just like talking through everything from that finale and that moment. Right. It's just a huge moment where sometimes that talking about this stuff is almost like, you know, we're not talking about Survivor. It's almost like it's poetry.
Yeah. And honestly, if you ask me, like, I used to write poetry in college, and this was pretty poetic. From as much as Survivor can get poetic, I felt this was a pretty poetic moment in the history of the show, considering we have 38 seasons now to sift through. Mm-hmm. But if you have anything more to say, we can keep going.
No, let's keep going.
Okay. So I thought it was an interesting move to go from the first season. Let's go to the latest season.
Okay.
Survivor. Chris Underwood, Edge of Extinction. So they're similar to Richard Hatch in an interesting way. There isn't a ton of things here for Chris for us to talk about with Chris's resume, but I'm curious to see if you could figure out what I'm talking about with his most ingenious move here.
Yes, he got voted out on day 9. Nobody else had ever thought of doing that.
Yeah, nobody ever thought about going to the edge of extinction and coming back on day 35 with a full belly of jury thoughts.
No, I would say that it has to be him going into the final four fire making.
Yeah, that's correct. You're 2 for 2. Mm-hmm. That would be the move, of course. And, you know, as much as people, I know there's a big buzz about Chris having all these advantages going into the game. And to be fair, there was a lot of disadvantages too. And some people would say, like, Chris giving up the immunity was like preordained, like he had to do it. He was not that smart. I'm like, no. There is something spectacular about Chris putting himself in harm's way, even if he had the blueprint, even if he knew it was other people that were on their mind. Chris Underwood choosing to give up his immunity necklace at the final four, basically pulling off the ballsiest move thus far with this fire making challenge that has been around for 4 seasons now, and I'm guessing it's going to be around for the rest of Shriver's lifespan.
Do you think so? I feel like it's going to run its course.
So, okay, I have thought about this too, and I'm like, if you asked me to bet, I would probably say it's going to stick around, just because it feels like producers are probably stubborn enough to feel like it's worth it. Like they've gotten a lot out of it, and they will continue with it despite the outcry of a lot of the fans. Or I don't know if it's like there's a big buzz with the bigger audience at large than the super fans. Obviously, I have a pulse on the super fans and what they think, but I don't know. Like, I would obviously love for it to go away. I'm not really in favor of it. I made a whole video about it where I complained for like 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's a better chance it will stay. But I agree with you. I think we have seen everything we could possibly see from it with Chris giving up and making this move here. First of its kind, maybe the last of its kind. But yeah, I don't know.
I think that what you saw, like, this was super exciting that, you know, Chris went into the final four fire making and then was able to go ahead and beat Rick and ultimately go on to win the game. But I just wonder, you know, we had this big fan favorite in Rick Devens, who now loses the final four fire making challenge. And not every single fan favorite is going to be somebody who can win the final four fire making challenge. And even once upon a time, did Suri lose a final four fire making challenge? Another time
did.
That she got screwed.
She lost to a fan favorite captain of sports, Daniel DiLorenzo.
Yeah. So I think that if we lose a couple of like big favorites now because of the final four fire making challenge,
that's true.
And maybe in a scenario where they wouldn't have been voted out if it wasn't a final, like Rick Devens would have been voted out either way at the final four. But I just wonder if the fans start to resent it of like, hey, my favorites keep losing the final four fire making.
Yeah, maybe it's just a matter of how many tweets Jeff Probst gets sent to him about complaining. What's the ratio? I agree on some level. Yeah, I could see like if enough of these Rick Devens type players, the producer's pets in some way, do end up becoming these fallen angels at the final four now, simply because this existed. I mean, in the case of Rick, he obviously would have been voted out anyway. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was more, I don't really know what that would have, like nothing in this case of Rick's case, he had to win the final challenge and in this case, build the fire. I could see it going out. I could see it going out and I would hope it does, but I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah. I think this might be an era, and I don't know if it's here to stay. Eventually, we'll get to Final Five fire making.
Oh no. Eventually there's no vote at all. We just resort to throwing coconuts at each other.
Well, it might be exciting.
Yeah, maybe a game of dodgeball.
Yeah. I want to know your reaction about the finale, because in talking about it, you know, you are impressed with Chris's move. What was your reaction to the overall somebody coming back from the edge of extinction and coming back to win the game? Because I know you're a historian of the show.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of the whole comeback, second chance type of thing, not Cambodia. I'm not a big fan of it. I wasn't a fan of it with Redemption Island, and even though I like Pearl Islands, I'm not a huge fan of it with the Outcast twist. Mm-hmm. In that case, we did happen to get Lil and Burton, who are pretty good characters. In the case of Edge of Extinction, yeah, I wasn't on board with it, and I'm still not on board with it. I personally would say it is the most broken twist that producers have ever put forth. I would be surprised if they could even top themselves at this point with that. It's really broken.
Don't tempt fate.
I know, right? This is what I do. I actually jokingly said, oh my God, in one of my videos before the finale of HHH, where we ever knew that the fire-making twist was happening, because at that time in the small window where I didn't know about the fire-making challenge being a Final Four thing, it hadn't existed yet. I started my channel in the middle of HHH. Season 35, before Ben had that happen, I jokingly said with one of my first videos, I said, I swear everything could be solved with a fire making challenge. That was the exact line that I used when I was talking about Kimmy and the Cambodia Final Six, where she got default eliminated.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of speculating on what they could have done differently in that case. And I jokingly said that. And all of a sudden, 2 weeks or a month later, I was like screaming, like, no, what did I put out into the universe? And people were laughing at me on my comment section. Mm-hmm. I've referenced it in other videos where I was like, oh, man. So, yeah, I don't like the Edge of Extinction twist as far as a gameplay mechanic goes. I'm a big video game player and board game player. And, you know, I sort of looked at it. I said it to Mike Bloom. It's kind of like adding an expansion pack onto a game that we all know and love. And I didn't like what it added, the new gameplay. And I said, you know what? Maybe in the future, we'll just keep it off the table and tuck it away and not go back to that twist. I don't think it... Survivor tried to go a little bit above and beyond with that. Same thing with Redemption Island in a way. Like, they tried to explore the psychological and the mental aspect and the human emotion aspect. And I speculated on this on my review video that I made for the season, where I said, you know, they needed more airtime. And I've heard this a lot from a lot of the players too, in their postseason interviews that you've been doing with them, including Chris, who's like, I wouldn't have it, the twist, come back at all. He's like, I think they should retire it. And then, like, he got him $1 million and that says something.
Yeah.
So yeah, I didn't like it. Chris coming back was in the moment watching it live. And this is sort of the hard part to reconcile. As much as I didn't like it from a gameplay perspective, from an entertainment value perspective, minute by minute, like that finale was firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
It really was giving us like great modern Survivor of a finale. Like, I've been less interested in Survivor finales than I was for all four of the tribal councils in that finale. You know, minute by minute, there was just something happening, whether I was in awe and in joy, or I was in disgust and like, no, don't let that happen. Like, don't play your idol on Chris.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Ultimately, I had a reaction and I was feeling good and bad. And I walked away from it being like, that was exhausting. But I'm hoping without the Edge of Extinction twist next season, hopefully we will have a similar outcome in that it's just as exciting, but maybe not nearly as broken.
Right.
I don't know. What was your take?
Pretty much the same thing. I hope they don't do it again, but you know, I was at the finale and it was thrilling and, you know, really exciting to watch. But in terms of Chris's actual move here, now, do you think that we will see anybody who wins the now? Now here's what's tricky. So Survivor 39.
Yeah, they
didn't see this. So it's possible. So you have to take it off the table. But I almost feel like that almost every single person that wins the Final Four immunity challenge is probably going to make this same move, right?
I would say possibly, but it depends. I think Chris knew that he was probably the strongest fire maker of the bunch. And it also is a little bit different because with the Edge of Extinction coming in, Chris kind of knew he had to do this. It wasn't Chris had to play to win at the final six, final five, final four. I think a lot of Survivor players like to play to not lose. Mm-hmm. And in the case, like you had Dominic, who I think played to not lose Survivor Ghost Island instead of playing to, say, beat Wendell and win. He obviously wanted to win and he was trying to win, but he thought maybe if I played it safe.
Yeah.
In the case of Chris, he pulled out something, but it was a very, like, the circumstances surrounding what he had to do were just so unorthodox, which is partially why I decided to put it on the list as a genius, because of how unorthodox it was and what it took to get him to do this. Could it happen? I mean, it'll be interesting. Maybe season 39 will have somebody do it too. And it'll be like, everyone will be like, oh, the first of its kind. And they're like, oh, we already got one up.
How about this for Dominic? What if Dominic would have put himself into the fire making challenge and taken on Laurel or Angela and said, Jeff, I got to take on Laurel's the biggest threat to win the game. Got to take her on. And then really like prop up Laurel. And then he wins the Final Four challenge. Everyone's like, oh my God, right. Dominic, he put himself into the challenge. He risked everything to do it. Now, we know Laurel infamously a jury vote for Wendell, but maybe he does with Angela. Because like I think that was, he could have definitely beat either of them from what I understand. Like just put yourself in, but don't necessarily take like the person who's the threat. And it's another thing on your resume.
I guess that's one more variation you could have on this little fire making challenge. We haven't seen fully yet. Like, give up, but don't go for the Rick Devins. Take out, you know, like maybe the Julie of the group or something. Somebody who probably doesn't have a great chance to win. You know, I don't know if the jury is going to be as impressed given that they probably weren't thinking Laurel or Angela in that season were going to win anyway. So it almost is like maybe it might even be more of like him doing what he did with how they perceived him handling Donathan with that final six.
Yeah.
It could be like, dude, you're just putting him down. Like, that was unnecessary. Like, you didn't need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they're like, that was amazing. You built a fire. Like, awesome.
I mean, the jury seems very impressed when it happens.
Yeah, a part of me really wants to be in the jury's mindset. Not that I would love to be on Survivor at some point, but I'm like, what would I'm curious to know how the jury's going to sit there and react watching people make fire again and again. Like at some point, it's got to get pretty old and I just can't be that wow. I don't know. Yeah, I hope it goes away. And Chris's move was definitely one of a kind so far. It took a little bit of ingenuity. Maybe it was a group effort. Maybe I should include everyone in this case. It was a group effort of Edge of Extinction players being like, this is what you got to do, Chris. And they all get credit for it. But, oh man, Edge of Extinction. What a roller coaster.
What a ride.
What a ride. Yeah, okay. Seriously.
All right. Let's come back to a normal season of Survivor.
Well, actually in this case, we're not going to go back to normal season, particularly because the next move, and I particularly put this one in this case, right after Edge of Extinction, is going to be Survivor, the Amazon.
Okay. All right. That is not a normal season.
It won't be normal in the particular circumstances we're handling it.
Okay.
This is Jenna Maraska. Now, you would know better than I do, which is kind of the interesting twist in the event of this podcast, which is why I'm glad we're recording this before I put out the video in the timeline of events. But Jenna Maraska, ingenuity. Okay. Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yes. Yes.
That there is.
She
I
was
hope it lines.
The first survivor to think about getting food by just taking her clothes off.
Oh, man. You know, that wasn't the move.
Richard got naked for nothing. He didn't hold out for anything.
He should have gotten naked on the final three for those orange slices.
Yeah. He did it just for fun. No. Fun. So I'm trying to think about what Jenna did that nobody else had done before.
Right. What does she have going for her that actually, in the case of Jenna, was the first of its kind?
Okay.
And I don't want to say like I'm scraping the bottom of the barrel here, but I do think that there is some speck of ingenuity. And I wanted to sort of partially because I was on a podcast with you who saw it firsthand, just sort of bring it up and go through it. And
all right, well, let me hear the move and then we can get into the discussion.
Okay, so the move itself, and I'm just anticipating this all, was when she gave her immunity necklace to Heidi at the final six.
Yes, I know that is a first.
That was the first, one of the only of its kind. I know it's been followed by Eric and not too many other players, really.
Yeah.
Surprising that she won. I don't think she was probably the front runner to win, maybe unlike Eric in that case. But she gave up her immunity necklace at the final six to Heidi to protect Heidi, make herself vulnerable from any potential shenanigans you and Matt might have pulled. Obviously, you guys didn't pull anything, and you ultimately went with Heidi and Jenna to vote out Christy, who was the wishy-washy, kind of a swing vote in that case.
Yeah.
So the ingenuity here was, and I did sort of have to like rack my brain a little bit harder than say, like, obviously, in the case of Richard or Chris, there was a little bit more face value.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, so for Jenna's, hers was, one, it was the first of its kind, giving up the immunity necklace. I know that she was kind of halfway out of the game, just mentally. She was checking out. She knew, I think, to some extent, that you were interested in keeping her around over Heidi, possibly taking her to the end and hopefully beating her. And she kind of thought, you know, this was a last minute plan you guys had devised, the four of you, you and Heidi and Jenna and Matt, to take out Christy. So she thought, you know what, I don't. She did take it off in the moment, saying this is for strategy, but I don't know how much you can believe that, obviously.
Yeah.
But she did say it was for strategy, so.
So I think this is complicated, but we can explore this, because it's very hard for me to be able to, you know, separate my perspective from, you know.
This was part of the uniqueness.
Jenna's perspective. In my mind, this is how I always saw this, where that Jenna didn't want to be there as much as Heidi. And Heidi, I thought, and I'll always say this, Heidi was the most manipulative player in the season. I was always more afraid of Heidi than I ever was of Jenna. And that's why when at the final five, I have the choice of should we vote out Heidi or should we vote out Jenna, I was always way more afraid of Heidi, because I thought that Heidi was calculated and manipulative. And Heidi has gone on to soar to tremendous heights, and she's the true little finger of she's Heidi is the based on what they've been able to, like, go look at bank statements. Heidi is the most successful player in the history of Survivor, and it's not close. So
is it?
I believe, to this day, I still believe Heidi was incredible and manipulative, and she's able to get whatever she's wanted in this world. And so I was very, very intimidated by Heidi. But at this point, Heidi, I think, was also working Jenna. And Jenna, I think at this point, this is around the time she wants to go home. She's talking about how she wants to leave and ultimately quit the game. And Heidi is talking a lot about how, you know, hey, it's not fair what you're doing to her. I want that Jenna wants to go home and you guys are making her stay. And that was a lot of the reason why. Now, was it all a ruse? Did was Jenna playing everybody by saying that she had some sort of tonsil problem and wanted to go home? Who's to say? I'm not ever going to pound the table and tell you that I know 100%. But it is what I believe. You know, Jenna wanted to go home. Heidi was really working her about how, you know, I should stay, and Heidi was like, would claw tooth and nail to stay in that game. And so I think that Heidi was putting the pressure on Jenna to say, hey, give me the immunity. But even if hypothetically we were going to vote out Heidi at that tribal council, it's not like, oh, well, now what do we do? It wasn't like anybody was going to scramble. And so I guess she prevented that from happening, but it wasn't like we couldn't figure out, okay, well, now, okay, let's just vote out Jenna at this tribal council. So,
right. I bring that up too. Sorry to interrupt. I brought that up too, where this isn't always a good move in Jenna's case, because hypothetically, if you guys did decide to not vote out Christy and she gives up her immunity necklace, worst case scenario, Jenna goes. And this isn't necessarily the same thing where, like, I don't think Jenna is any worse for wear. If you guys did flip on Heidi,
I think Butch does, then Butch just votes for Jenna instead.
Yeah, and so does Christy, right?
Yeah.
Like, you and Matt certainly could have, if you really wanted to, just flip on them. I mean, it might have burnt more bridges than necessary given the circumstances, but I was just, thinking about, like, in the case of, say, Chris, who gave up immunity What's the difference between Chris doing it and, say, Jenna doing it? And, like, obviously, there's a huge difference. Chris needed to do that to win. I don't know if Heidi at all needed to do that. And, in fact, it might have actually hurt her. It may not have been an optimal move, mostly because, like, she didn't really gain anything. You guys didn't flip. She could have been voted out. She did receive two votes. And, yeah. So, I'm like, this... There's something to her doing it for the first
time. It's historic.
Maybe it's historic. It's very rare. We don't really see this very often. I would love to see it happen more often in Survivor.
But pretty. Yeah, that could have been me because I was very close to winning the immunity in that same challenge that Jenna won. Frickin' Butch, it was a shuffleboard challenge. And then he came in and I was closest to the X and he came in with his tile and then like knocked mine into Jenna and like he like knocked Jenna onto the X and ultimately gave her the immunity. But my plan was that if I did win that immunity, I was going to give the immunity to Christy. Because Christy was in this position where there were three of us. There was myself and Matt and Butch, the four people that voted against Alex. And then there was Jenna and Heidi, who were not friends with Christy the entire game. And they were trying to get her to vote with them and go. And they said, well, we're promising you the final three. And I was saying to Christy, well, we're promising you we're promising you the final four. But, you know, it's going to be a tie. And she's like, yeah, I don't know. And she was going back and forth. And I thought that would have meant something to her. If I would have won the necklace and given it to her, I don't think that she would have turned around and flipped on me. And I don't know if it would have been a live tribal council where I don't see a scenario where Matt and Butch would have turned around on me. But I feel like.
And so the idea was to give it to her and then probably take out Heidi.
Heidi or Jenna. And that's what that was what I would have done. And then when Jenna had the immunity, then that's when, you know, we spent the afternoon of like trying to. I was really racking my brain, and then Christy was being so wishy-washy about the whole thing. And what she had said to me was, well, I'll let you know right before tribal council. And unfortunately for Christy, that wasn't good enough. And she did right before tribal council let me know. She said, like, okay, I'm going to vote for Jenna. I'm like,
is that on the way to tribal?
That was, you know, right. She had said it to me. We're putting our mics on us, like, to get ready to sit or like to go to tribal council. I know you talk about this in the Tina video in one of the earlier parts.
Part two. Yeah.
Yeah. She had said to me, like, I'm going to vote Jenna. I'm like, and I wish you would have. Yeah, I wish you would have told me that before. I really, it's a little late. Sorry about that.
Right. You know, you're already locked in too much.
Internal monologue is what I'm saying. Like, I'm like, oh, okay, good.
Of course. You know, and I just want to say, I did actually go back and I went back and listened to the evolution of strategy to hear your take on this because I was curious to know if this move was at all worth investigating and talking about in my video because I was like, you know, there is something to it. There's not a lot to it, and it'll be interesting to get your take live now in 2019.
Well, it's fun to talk about.
It's certainly fun to talk about, you know, and obviously I've seen a lot of people who have propped it up, and then there's people who've broken it down, but I thought, you know, there's no better way of getting to the truth of it all than
hearing
straight.
And it's my perspective. I'm sure if you talk to Jenna...
And that's true, too.
She would tell you that, like, oh, no, absolutely, it was, you know, this was strategy, and I did this because it was, like, my insurance that Rob was going to... But you know, it might have been insurance for her, but it was, it had no impact on what I did.
Right. And I was like, maybe there's more to it that nobody knew about. Like, was she at all playing to the jury? No, she probably wasn't. But yeah, that's where I was with that one. So that was a small video, small moment. And I was like, you know what? It doesn't have to be necessarily the best move or even a great move. To be ingenious, maybe ingenious is pushing
Who's to say? You know, I talk about the show where it's like, oh, well, Rick, what he's doing at Tribal Council didn't have any impact on the vote. But, you know, not that she was in jeopardy of losing Alex's vote, but I'm sure Alex on the jury, he was delighted to say, oh, it looks like Jenna is like throwing off the whole plan by giving the necklace to Heidi. And then Christy gets voted out and maybe the whole jury is talking about like, boy, did you guys see that? Boy, Jenna made a big move in front of the jury. I mean, she goes on to win 6-1. So it had no impact on what I did, but I can't say that, you know, whether, you know, Dave Johnson walked away like, wang, ring, that was impressive.
Yeah, you know, you got Roger on the edge of extinction jury just jumping up and down cheering for Jenna to do it. You know, you never know what we're afraid of what he's going to do next. But anyway, should we go? We can go to the next one
sure,
now.
Sure.
no, anyway, but it was really cool. I did go back and listen to The Evolution of Strategy and get your hot take on it with Josh Wigler. And it was interesting to hear you pretty much said exactly. And I was like, I wonder if there was more to it. So it's interesting now.
Fun to talk about.
It's really fun to talk about for sure. These little tiny snapshots in the history of Survivor as we sort of dot our way around from the journey of 20 years ago to today.
Mm-hmm.
So next one is going to be one of my favorite seasons of all time, possibly my number one favorite. I haven't actually ever ranked the seasons, and one of my favorite winners. And this is going to be a move that might also be pretty apparent. It is Todd Herzog from Survivor China.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any idea what his ingenious move was in Survivor China?
Well, the big one that he gets the most credit for is his final tribal council performance. But I'm guessing that's not where you went with this.
It isn't. No, I did talk about that a little bit in a previous video.
Okay.
But no, it wasn't his masterful handling of John Robert or that jury.
How about when he told James about the idol that was over at John Who?
Yes, that was the move. That's correct. I think you might be 4-for-4 at this point,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm not surprised to see. But yes, the move itself was Todd not only telling James about the John Who, the opposing tribe's location for the Hidden Meanwhile, it was also him devising the whole plan to win the reward challenge, hopefully kidnap James from the opposing tribe for the afternoon, give him the idol that he didn't even have yet by taking the clue. There's a lot of little details in this move that sort of played out over an entire episode. I believe it was episode 6,
mm-hmm.
where they win the reward challenge,
right.
Fei Long. They kidnap James. He gives them a clue. He has to give one of the members a clue. He gives it to Todd, who at that point had 4 clues from the season already.
Mm-hmm.
So he was loaded. Nobody had found the hidden immunity idol yet. Todd figures out where the idol is. He goes on the hilarious idol hunt that is pretty unique in the history of idol hunts, where he and Amanda are trying to grab the idol from the top of that banister in front of their camp. And then
yeah.
Frosty walks in. Todd gets the idol in front of Frosty, has to basically tell Frosty to sit and stay. And then he runs and he gets to James and he gives James the idol. And he says, this is what you need to do. This is how you need to play it. This is the move we need to make, where he says, take the idol, throw the next immunity challenge, go to tribal council, use the idol when Jeff Probst says this, and blindside the girls. Also, get the John Who idol, or at mm-hmm. least if you can't get it, be aware of the fact that they might have it. And I thought that this had so many parts to it that I had to include it. I'm also a big fan of Todd, but it implemented so many different shifting elements to the reward challenge, to the reward itself, to the idol clue, to finding the idol, to giving it to James, who's on the other tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it all fell apart.
Yeah.
When
it's such a great moment
in
the show.
It's such a fantastic episode itself and a moment in that season.
Yeah, because there's not a lot of payoff between the James and Denise relationship. Like it's set up at the beginning of the season, and you know, I think that James talks about Denise, and I think he like describes her as like he thinks she's like kind of sexy or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, this has got weird. And then they're very tight, like they're like the two like hard workers at Fei Long. And then we get this scene where they're in the gross food eating challenge against each other. And Denise cannot eat the balut. And she just can't do it. And James is like trying so hard to throw the challenge. And he just like he does it like a mercy that he ends up eating the thing so that he doesn't have to throw the challenge because she can't do it.
Yeah, I know. It was really interesting how there was this elaborate plan going on, and then it all came down to the lunch lady couldn't eat her lunch.
Yeah.
You know? And it took was Denise just not being able to eat the chicken fetus to blow it all up into smoke. And Todd was now actually sitting in a pretty dicey spot from that point forward, thanks to his ingenuity, because he now had James, who was an ally moving forward, still in the game, but he had two idols in his pocket. Obviously, this was earlier in the history of Survivor. It was only the second season ever with that idol that had to be played before the votes were read. So I'm sure if James was in a more modern season, he might have known better than to not play the idol at the final seven when he had two of them. That's insane. Mm-hmm. Think about in modern times, like if Rick Devens is in the final seven or whatever, like he's got two idols in his pocket, they're being played. For sure.
Yeah.
So it did sort of be a move that is, you know, both great and very, I thought it was very ingenious of what Todd was able to pull off here, but at the same time, it did sort of put him in a situation where he created his own monster, and now he had to find a way to slay that dragon, which he did. He got lucky, he did. But yes, that was the ingenuity of Todd Herzog.
Yeah. No, it's a fun scene. And then I always wonder how Todd, you know, just let James keep both of the idols, that James wasn't giving them back.
I know. I was interested if he didn't like say, could I get my idol back? Like at that point, they're on good terms. It's not like James is going next, right? I mean,
right.
Unless John or Bear had his say or something. But yeah, he's like, you know, could I get my idol back? No. Okay. Well, we got to vote you out now, or you got to play your idol.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's an interesting element to it at that time. I'm curious, like, in the evolution of the hidden immunity idol, like, what that would be like to go to the early days. Wonder if Todd did ask it, they just didn't show it because he didn't give it back,
mm-hmm.
or like how that works.
You know, I think that's a little bit like the how do you spell your name? I think that when you start asking for, can I hold on to idols? I feel like I've asked Todd about this in podcasts, and I don't think he would have liked it back, but I don't think he ever point blank asked James for it back.
Yeah, that's good to know. That's cool. Yeah. I'm guessing you probably just didn't bother because it would have been too much of a red flag or something.
Mm-hmm. Right. And especially when it got to the point where they're sending him home with two of those idols, when you start asking to hold on to them, then that really is going to raise suspicion.
Yeah, I think so. But I don't know. You know, you never know with James. He got voted out with two idols in his pocket. Maybe being like, James, I need it. I'm going to get voted out tonight. I heard them whispering from the water well, or Todd had a little like a spy cave or something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, he could have played it differently. I do know Todd was pretty close. I had talked about how at the final seven, this move was kind of foibled by PG and Eric, particularly Eric, actually,
mm-hmm.
for what happened there with the vote. Todd could have been blindsided or taken out if James had been pinged by PG to play the idol. That would have been almost in similar fashion to JT in a sense, where he gave Russell his idol in Heroes versus Villains, even wrote a letter explaining to JT or to Russell, similar to how Todd told James how to play the idol, like, this is what you got to do. And then all of a sudden it's JT's idol that probably spells his demise here. It could have been the same way with Todd if James had played the idol there. But anyway, it didn't happen. So
mm-hmm. dodged a bullet.
He dodged a major bullet and he ended up winning $1 million. So good for Todd.
Okay. All right. What's number five?
All right. Number five. So at this point, we're about halfway through the list. I thought it would be a good time to bring it back a little bit. We've gotten pretty strategic and in depth. This next move is going to be probably, if we thought Jenna Marasca's was one of the more questionable ones, I think this one is going to be a little more interesting ones. But again, I saved it for the podcast. This is going to be one that I'm pretty sure you won't get. And not that it's like an amazing move, but I think you won't get it. It is a move by Tyson Apostle from Survivor Blood versus Water.
Yes.
Now, Tyson did do a lot that season.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what you could qualify as being unique or different from his overall resume, mm-hmm. but I'd be curious to know if you have any
how
idea.
How about Tyson really milked an injury?
Oh my God, you got it.
Yeah.
That's it. There you go. I am impressed. That was the one move I thought this might be a bit.
No, that's a really good one. That's a really good one.
It was, you know, and Tyson had a lot of, there was a good little funny storyline in the pre-merge about him doing this. He got injured in episode 3 when they did the sumo at sea challenge with Hayden Moss of Big Brother fame. And they did the sumo at sea. It was him versus Hayden, and Hayden just crushed him in about 2 seconds flat. Tyson had his shoulder injured.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a great secret scene that somebody sent me that was of 2 minutes of Tyson being checked out by the nurse, because people have speculated that maybe Tyson was faking the injury. Maybe there's more to it than just that, like not just milking the injury, but maybe even faking it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody had pointed out, and this was actually reminded to me from Mario Lanza, who runs the Funny 115, mm-hmm. that he included a quote where somebody had said that Tyson had brought I'm guessing you probably brought it up on your podcast at some point before Blood versus Water. And I there's no way I could track it down, so I couldn't verify it. But he was talking about the ability to possibly injure yourself intentionally to reduce your threat level or something. Because he was a physical threat in Token Genes. And he's like, I would go in and, you know, intentionally get hurt and milk that for all it's worth.
Yeah.
And then we kind of saw that play out, but I don't think he intentionally got hurt by Hayden. I think Hayden just steamrolled him there. So
right, he I believe it, he did get hurt, but then he was able to really, you know, make people think that he was hurt for longer than he actually was, and then he's able to really, you know, turn on the afterburners and wins the last couple of immunity challenges in that season. But he is able to, you know, take what is, you know, the thing that is, you know, the biggest perceived threatening thing about him, which is his, you know, physical aptitude in the challenges, and then basically like, I've lost my powers. You know, you don't have to worry about me. I'm not a threatening person that you need to go after.
Yeah, he's kind of like intentionally putting on the fat suit, I guess.
Yeah.
That Colby had in Heroes versus Villains. Yeah, I mean, it's actually not a bad strategy that I think we've heard people speculate other players should consider doing, like maybe Joe.
That's, in this I've been saying season. For years, Joe needs to gain 200 pounds. Forget the haircut.
Yeah, you know, forget the image. You don't need the girls on Twitter, on Instagram aren't going to win you $1 million, Joe. You gotta go out there and just gain a few pounds and throw some challenges, and you're golden. You're golden in a completely different way, but you're golden nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, I talked about Tyson. He has some great scenes that are spawned by him having this injured shoulder, where he's lying on the hammock, and then Jervis is like, "Oh, you take it easy, dude." And a couple other, like Monica and Laura, are like, "Don't worry, you need to just rest as much as possible," which is just music to Tyson's ears.
Mm-hmm.
He does the whole Coconut Bandits thing where he runs around and he basically he says he wants to steal as much food as possible. It just sort of like being injured enables him to sort of act lazy without being necessarily pegged as the lazy guy.
Mm-hmm.
And because he has an excuse.
Yeah.
And people were very much on board with his excuse and it looked legitimate. And I think it was. So I just thought there was a little bit of ingenuity that you don't see. I will say there might have been a case with Yule mm-hmm. in Cook Islands, who had brought up, I think at the reunion, how he tried to act sick he tried to play up a sickness he had for a little bit mm-hmm. to make people think he was weaker, because obviously he's a very physically fit guy. But he said he dropped it pretty because nobody cared or nobody bought it or whatever. It wasn't decent enough to carry on. But in Tyson's case, I thought that it was pretty great that he was able to make a lot. He milked a lot of it. He managed to make a little bit of lemonade out of that lemon that he was given.
Yeah, I love to talk about this stuff where in Survivor, often, you know, strengths are weaknesses and weaknesses are strengths. And that Tyson was able to take this, you know, perceived strength that he had and lose that. And then also, he does a lot of things around the camp, like, for instance, like, you know, with eating the food. I don't know how many people were on to him with that, but that, you know, he wants people to sort of like look at him and not ever look at him as being like a perfect person, because that makes you so much more threatening. And he's talked about where sitting out of the challenges is also like where, oh, you know, sitting out of the challenges, you know, makes you look bad. Well, he kind of wants to look bad because he doesn't want people to think that he's like a, you know, a perfect person to go to the end.
Yeah, exactly. And he did that too in that one challenge where he was given the chance to sit out for eating all that food while he got to watch the minions beneath him play for immunity.
Yeah.
And he was sitting there chowing down on the chicken and whatnot, just chucking him in the bushes.
Jervis,
and he's just totally being a jerk, playing it up. He knows this is like both he's getting, you know, nourishment and food, but he's also getting to play like the part he wants to play. And there's a strategic element too that, in the case of, you know, just like his shoulder injury, just plays up this strategic game that he was executing pretty well.
Okay. Pretty. Anything else on Tyson here?
I think that's it.
Okay.
There wasn't too much for me to talk about, but no, We can move on now to...
Well, before we get to the second half of the list, I just want to take a moment and thank one of our sponsors for this episode of the podcast. And those are friends over at Dahl. Always ingenious. If you've been listening for the past couple of weeks, you've probably heard me talk about Dahl smoothie blends, but they also have these amazing Dahl acai bowls too. With the weather starting to warm up, there's nothing that cools me down like a delicious acai bowl. It's light and refreshing. And if you've ever had one, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. These smoothie bowls are great for a delicious breakfast or anytime as a snack. And they're so convenient with Dahl acai bowls. There's no washing or prep work, no blender to clean. All you have to do is let it thaw and put it in the microwave for 30 seconds, grab a spoon, and enjoy. Instead of going to a smoothie bowl shop every morning, it's so much more convenient to just pull one out of the freezer rather than having to go out and wait in line. And Dahl acai bowls are a fraction of the price and just as delicious. They come in three great flavors, original, protein, and tropical. And the best part is each one is 230 calories or fewer. So if you're ready for something tasty first thing in the morning or to sneak in a quick snack break, try Dahl acai bowls. Find them in your frozen aisle. Okay, let's get to the second half of the list.
Yeah, this has been quite a trip so far. We've been able to talk about this more than I expected.
We can talk about Survivor moments all day.
Okay, yeah, for sure. Honestly, though, I've never had such long conversations. Like, my longest ever, I think, was with Mike and Liana. So I was like, I talk to myself a lot, which is what my channel is, basically, mm-hmm. me talking to myself. So I'm like, oh boy, I hope I can manage to hang on with a conversation with another human being. Because I talk to my wife about Survivor, and she shuts down after about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Does
she watch it, though?
She does. And in fact, she's actually watched most of the seasons at this point, and Big Brother, too. She's gotten into it thanks to me. I mean, she wouldn't watch it if it wasn't for me. But
that's nice.
Yeah, it's really great. And The Amazing Race, she really likes it, too. She's really jumped on board with my passion and commitment to it. So it's been great. Honestly, it's definitely brought us together closer. And, you know, she doesn't have as much of like to talk about, but she listens to Rob as a pod. She listens to you a lot. She listens to you every, you know, all the know-it-alls. And
okay,
you know, we've considered going to the live know-it-alls before.
Oh yeah. Well, let me know anytime you want to make it out there.
Okay. I mean, I know you guys were in Philly recently. I'm actually in Annapolis, which is like an hour away.
Okay.
So maybe in the future I can always, we'll see what happens.
Okay. All right. What is number six that we're going to talk about today?
All right, number six, most ingenious moves of all time. Not all time, just most ingenious for these top 20. Mm-hmm. We have a move from the only person to three-peat this video series, Tony Vlachos from Survivor Kagayan.
Okay.
Tony obviously was in part one, and he was in part two. I put up a move for each part. He is now here in part three. We've already talked about a lot of Tony. What do you think could have been the third ingenious move,
yes,
in my opinion,
okay,
from Tony Vlachos.
All right. Now, you've talked about Spy Shacks.
Yes.
You've talked about Tony giving the clues to Jeremiah and making everybody be very suspicious of Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm.
Could it be similar to what happened with Tony making up his own rules? What about where he told everybody that the Tyler Perry idol was still in play at the final four when it expired at five?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
That's the move. Well, you are six for six.
Yeah, I noticed when I watched the earlier part where you talked about how Tony was able to take the idol clues and then make up new rules for them, then I was like, oh yeah, that's kind of like exactly what he does at the end of the game too.
It is. And he applies it to a slightly different element of the game. He takes another part. It's sort of an unknown variable to most of the cast at that time. They didn't know what this mystery idol was that showed up at the merge. Mm-hmm. And he just started making up his own rules to like scare everyone into thinking he was like robbing the bank without a gun. But if they think he has the gun, they might not, you know, turn on him or something. They might give him the money,
mm-hmm.
which they did, incidentally.
Yeah.
yeah, the move itself was when Tony is bluffing everyone with the mysterious super idol that he found somewhere in the middle of the post-merge of Survivor Kagayan. And you know, an element of it was also his bag of tricks that I didn't even talk about, but was pretty prevalent. A recurring theme with Tony in the post-merge was this fake bag of tricks that he didn't even have. He started bringing up the bag of tricks without even having an idol in his pocket. He brought it up after he played the first idol that he messed up with on LJ. And then he started bringing up the bag of tricks after that, which I thought was very interesting. He didn't actually have anything in that bag.
Mm-hmm. But people were paralyzed by what he was potentially going to have in his bag of tricks.
Yeah, you know, there's some element. I don't know to what extent it affected everyone else. But for sure, we know, obviously, Tony didn't really be targeted enough to get voted out. It didn't. I don't know if it dissuaded anyone from voting or not. But I do know that he was sort of throwing out these ideas of trying to use, you know, scare everyone else off his scent a little bit. Be like, look, if you go for me, you're going to get in trouble. You know, I'm going to pull out an idol and I'm gonna take you out. Like, it's that simple. So, you know, we'll see what happens when the idols gets played, when the bag of tricks comes out, as you would say.
So what about in terms of this move that, you know, brilliant on Tony's part to pull it off. Do you feel like that the producers should define the rules on these things or let the players define them, and then that, you know, you have to see what happens. Jeff will validate whether Tony's thing is real or not at Tribal Council.
Yeah, I do think from a sake of balancing the game a little bit, throwing out the Super Idol one is already imbalanced as it is, let alone having it be mysterious makes it doubly so kind of imbalanced, I think, for the sake of the maybe integrity of the game, you could say. It certainly wasn't a necessary addition, I think, to Survivor. It wasn't back when it was first introduced. They certainly found a good happy middle with how the idol has existed. So I do think, like, Tony got away with something that is not very possible in most seasons, where he was given at the merge episode, the new idol was introduced on the note at the merge, and they said it has mysterious. It's a new idol, but they didn't disclose any information. So I think that, I think that Tony kind of got away with something that probably most players couldn't. I guess you could think of it as somebody saying, well, there is a super idol, but there already is precedence for Tony's season having the note given out where everyone was like, okay, we're aware of it. We don't know what it does yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Although I will say now with, you know, 10 seasons of hindsight from that, I think it's actually not that different from a lot of things that we've seen happen since then, like Ron Clark giving an expired advantage menu to Rick Devens, right, or Chrissy Hofbeck trying to pass off the expired idol that Ryan Ulrich put in her bag and give it to Ben and say it was a real idol, or all the fake idols that we've seen made. So it was almost like that Tony found a prototype for an advantage that was expired, and then basically, you know, tried to, you know, bluff people with it. And while it was kind of foreign in Survivor 28, I think it's been something that we've seen more of since that point.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of people getting very creative with advantages, especially after Kagyan, and we've seen them be more prevalent in seasons. People are getting more creative, and it's interesting. It's a different twist that has changed, I think, the game of Survivor. And if you guys ever did a volume 4 of the Evolution of Strategy, it would probably be a big point of advantage management is for sure a thing that you see come up again and again, particularly with the winners. They understand how important they are to not only procure them, but to also manage them and know where they are, where they might be, how they're going to affect their game. And Tony, of course, there weren't advantages in Kagyan outside of the idols, but he certainly, you know, played it up like there was something bigger than just an idol there, which there was. But he actually played it up with the bag of tricks before he even knew exactly what the idol was. So there is obviously a sense of ingenuity already going in Tony's mind, which is why I chose to put him on the list in the first place.
Yeah, Tony is such a transformative character in the history of Survivor. I mean, he really does usher in the big moves era of Survivor in terms of how aggressive he plays the game. Now, you know, Sierra Easton votes out her mom, which is really sets off the, you know, the thirst for big moves. But then Tony comes along and he is responsible for so many big swings in Kagyan. And then in terms of when we talked about the evolution strategy in Survivor 30, when Dan Foley gets the extra vote, that really does then start off the advantage era of Survivor. And Josh and I, when we talked about that, you know, I had said that while the extra vote here like doesn't really come into play, I think that this you know, next set of 10 seasons, I think that by the time we get to the end of this, we're going to know exactly what you're supposed to do with this thing when it comes into play. And there's been so many advantages in the 30s.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we saw just a tiny morsel of it pop up with season 30. We saw, maybe like you said, with Tony, it was a bit of a prototype of an idea that hadn't existed in a tangible form, and then it showed up two seasons later, and now it has just spread like wildfire throughout the 30s of Survivor. And who knows, you know, where sky's the limit. We even had a whole season dedicated to advantages, dedicated to the memory of deceased advantages.
Yes, yeah.
So who knows, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I think they're going to be a mainstay at the very least. Maybe not the fire challenge, but moves like with Tony. He started out by bluffing, having an advantage, having a power that nobody knew what it was. And he utilized it both at the final five when he actually didn't. I was looking for this as I rewatched. I rewatched the whole post-merge of Kagyan to make sure that I understood exactly what the timeline was for Tony's ingenuity here. And he brings up the bag of tricks without the idol. And then he finds the idol. He finds a regular idol and the super idol. So he's just on cloud nine, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tony's always on cloud nine, but he was just on cloud 10 or something, 150,000%. And he doesn't tell anyone about the second idol, the super idol. He tells them about the regular one, but it's at the final five.
Yes.
When he knows that Spencer's the big target, Spencer wins immunity. He tells Trish that he has the super idol. It's the first time we are known that he is telling other people, but he doesn't tell him. He doesn't even tell her, his number one ally, what it does. He just says, I have it. And, you know, it can be used, and it'll be used, you know, in next round at the final four. He brings it out. I think he does bring it out at the final five. He plays his regular idol at the final five, which wasn't really necessary. But then he bluffs with the super idol to secure himself a final three passage at the final four. He does it. He sort of sows the seeds ahead of time with the bluffing, which is ultimately the move that I wanted to, ultimately the move that I'm putting on the list was the ingenuity of bluffing with the move at the final five to secure himself a spot in the event that he didn't win immunity at the final four, which he didn't. He got pretty lucky in that Spencer was clearly the target. And if Spencer had won immunity, then what happens? Because Tony is clearly the biggest threat. But then they realized nobody seemed to not, they all believed him for the most part, and they didn't target him at the final three, at the final four, which I think it goes to show there's something to it. You know, bluffing is a huge element of the game. And we've seen a lot of players past Tony really take advantage of that to great success and not to great success. Yes. So,
and that final five episode of Kagyan might be, if not one of my favorite Survivor episodes of all time, maybe my all time favorite.
Oh yeah, that's the llama comes out. It's part of it. You get Tony versus Cash.
So good.
You get Wu talking about being the strange student, who's in this broken family. They're just, oh man, it's a pleasure.
Great episode.
So we can move on from Tony.
Okay,
that will be the last of Tony on the list. No more Tony for now.
For now.
The next move is, what is this now? This is number seven on the list. We have a move that is, again, we sort of are ping-ponging, no different than Tony did, with the level of ingenuity. And if Tony was at a very high level of ingenuity, we might be going back down with this next one. It is from Bob Crowley from Survivor Gabon, your favorite season.
What did Bob do that was ingenious? Was it that he made the fake idol?
Yes. And so this is going to get a little bit, we're going to have to explain this one a little bit, but the ultimate move is, yes, he did make a very good fake idol.
Made a convincing fake idol. Now, Yao Man made a very unconvincing fake idol, and so did Ozzy prior to that.
Ozzy did too. Yes. And so I did take note of that. Ozzy just picked up an effing stick and put holes in it and a smiley face, which amazingly worked.
Yes.
That's the ingenuity of Ozzy, I guess. If he won, that would have been an ingenious thing. Yao Man took half of a coconut shell.
Made the happy face.
It, put, he made a happy face on it.
That's the move. You put a happy face on things.
Right. You write a little happy face, and he wrote I on it, you know, just in case people weren't sure what they just found. It was, oh, this is the immunity idol. Of course, nobody found it. I don't think it was found. No, it wasn't.
Or at least we didn't see it.
Bob's was an interesting case because Ozzy and Yao Man both hid theirs, hoping that somebody else would find it. And in Bob's case, he didn't hide it with the intent of anyone finding it. He wanted to create a fake one to sort of, he actually brought up the notion I just mentioned with Tony, where he actually has a confessional after he makes the idol where he says, you know, it's kind of like robbing the bank. And if they think you have the gun, that's all, as long as they think you have it, it'll do the same thing as if you had a gun in the first place. So I'm pretending like it's going to be something that'll scare them, but I don't actually have anything. Now, I do want to quickly point out, and I think you probably knew this, but maybe you didn't. The first fake idol ever made wasn't actually by Yao Man. Do you know who it was?
The first fake idol.
Was not made by Yao Man. I thought it was Yao Man until I explored this.
I don't know.
So it was actually by Austin Carty on Survivor Panama, Exile Island. And I wasn't sure how I could believe that, but I actually found a clip that exists there out there, and it's of Austin being interviewed by Julie Chen. And it's the most random thing ever, and it shows even footage of him creating the fake idol on Exile Island from Survivor Panama. And I was like, he took a stick similar to Ozzy, and he took a medallion from the very first reward challenge of the season on the very first scene where the four tribes show up. Austin gets a medallion for winning the reward, and then he keeps it in his pocket, and he goes to Exile on his boot episode, and he puts the medallion on a stick, and he says, I don't think this is going to work. It's like a scepter, and I'll see what I can do with it. But then it turns out he didn't do anything with it. He didn't bring it out. He didn't play it. He left it. It was just a non-entity, so it didn't make the episode. But I thought that was an interesting bit of history, because when I'm talking about ingenuity, if the original thing was, my idea was Bob, he created a very elaborate fake idol, and the ingenuity for me was above and beyond what Austin or Yao Man or Ozzy did. It was Bob basically scavenging around and just sort of, maybe it was not even intentionally done, but he had little knickknacks, little baubles that he had collected with beads.
He's like a tinkerer. And
he is a tinkerer. He's you know, the all around Boy Scout, as Corinne said. He explained at the reunion, he grabs the feathers and the beads from the immunity flag as he goes to fake. He fakes a yawn and he just sort of yanks it off as he heads off to Exile Island. And he's like, you know, he kind of knew, I think it was a premeditated act. He knew that if he couldn't find the idol, which he couldn't, because Sugar had it, then he was going to have to do something else. And I also think there's some element of Bob was not a super fan of the game. He was, I believe, recruited to be on the show. And he probably didn't know much of Yao Man or Ozzy or Austin, the history of the fake. He might have seen
Ozzy. A lot of us don't know much about Austin.
Yeah, it's true. We even watched. Yeah, even if you've seen the season, you wouldn't. So I just wanted to think, like, there's a little bit of ingenuity with Bob and the level of detail and attention he gave to not only creating an idol, but creating an idol that was better looking than most of the real idols production produces that could pass off more as fake idols than Bob's real idols. He created two of them, lest we forget. He created two of these elaborate idols, and they kind of fooled people on both occasions, so much that I think... And you can obviously stop me if you want to interject and say anything, but when I was listening, to the Evolution of Strategy with you talking about this season and just sort of going through it myself, trying to see what nuggets of strategy we can get, especially from Bob, because he wins the season. At the final seven, Bob has this second fake idol he created at Exile, and he tempts Kenny and he tempts Crystal into splitting their vote, which I think was... sort of an unintentional, maybe, I don't know how much, to what degree I can give the credit to Bob, but it did cause Kenny to split the vote and vote for Maddie, which caused bad blood the next round. And it sort of created a downward spiral for Kenny and Crystal that paved the way for Bob to get sort of sneak in that crack. He sort of was like chiseling at this alliance, maybe trying to get a crack in them. And I think the idol was there to sort of do something with it, but I don't know how much credit I can really give to Bob for it. But I do think that there was a lot of ingenuity with what Bob was doing with the idol, creating the idol, putting it together, tinkering around with his beads and his feathers and his cones and his resin from the trees. Yeah. That I thought it was worthy of a mention because it's the first of its kind, and really it's one of the only of its kind to create such an elaborate
idol. I would say it's more ingenious in terms of the long-term effect that it had on the game, more so than anything it had to do with Bob going on to win the season, because there have been...
Right, it's more like he's a winner, not because of it.
So many fake idols have been made, and now multiple fake idols are being made per season, and... Bob was really the first person, you know, he was the true game changer in terms of like, okay, steal the beads. And sorry, Austin Carty. But in terms of like, you know, a move that people actually saw, and then people would go on to make so many of them. Although we see it in Gabon. And then do we see another good fake idol for a while? I feel like it takes a while to show back up before then they're in every single season.
Yeah, I think really the next great idol that you could compare might have been Joe with Worlds Apart, which isn't for another 13 seasons. Yeah. I know that there are a couple of fake idols along the way. You get Rupert with the rock.
Yes, with the rock in his pocket. Shorts. Right.
I think Dale might have done something in San Juan del Sur.
Yeah, there's like a thing on the well, and he like holds on to it and bluffs that it's an idol.
Right, with John.
Yes.
So, yeah, I do think that there's some elements with Bob. He went to great lengths to create this elaborate idol that definitely upped the standard, maybe, of the requirement for what a fake idol should be like. I mean, it's fascinating to consider they made a twist where a player could make a fake idol with a fake idol kit.
Yes.
Like, I think Bob could still make a better fake idol with nothing than with a fake idol kit.
Yes, probably.
but, yeah. So ultimately, that was the morsel of ingenuity we got from Bob Crowley that I thought, you know what, I want to give a little bit of credit. He definitely did more than I think the average viewer thinks about. And his idols definitely had a pretty big impact on the season toward the end of it.
And I think it helps that the idol was in the scene with Randy being voted out, which gets replayed a lot. So I think that also really helped the legend of that fake idol.
Oh, for sure. Between the ingenuity of how he put it together to the amazing reaction of Randy being bluffed by discovering it was fake with his head turn, and the reaction of Sugar with her cackling. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, it got a lot of great clips out.
And I know Randy Bailey listens to the podcast, so I want to say this is also the worst moment in the history of Survivor.
Yeah, this is not that ingenious. It's probably...
You should make a new list of the worst moment in the history of Survivor and talk all about this.
Well, I did make a top five worst move by winners.
Okay.
That was the second video I ever made.
Put
so
this on.
Maybe Randy
go back
might,
and,
want,
go back
Randy
and
might want to check that out. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Three more to go.
Three more to go, and we're in for a good blazing finish. I won't need to do any precautionary warnings or whatever, where I'm sort of downplaying what these winners did. The next winner on this list is another move that I think is pretty evident. And I was actually going back looking at it. I was I was more impressed when I went back to look at it than I was when I first saw it on my screen, even though I was very impressed the first time. This is Nick Wilson from Survivor David versus Goliath. Okay. Do you know what that move might be?
I'm going to say that it was the playing the advantage that he had. The vote steal where he stole Allison's vote.
That was actually not the move.
All right.
But that was a great one by him. I mean,
let me get
a ball again.
Then was it when he planted his fake idol?
No. Okay.
All right. Tell me what was the move that Nick Wilson made?
So the move that I was very much captivated by. I was very captivated at the time, and I still am to this day. And I was given a secret scene by a subscriber who showed it to me, and I was like, oh, that's great. That was a great move. It was when Nick put forth the idea, and it was his move, and I had to make sure that it was his move and not anyone else's. It really was Nick who helmed it. The idea to split the votes on the minority between him and Davey and Christian at the final 12 to take out Johnny Mundo, Impact, Ultra, the Shaman of Sexy, you know, Monday Night Delight, when they voted him out after the... Basically, they were the first of their kind to plan around a majority idol being played. They split the vote in a minority case, which is the only time that it's ever happened, let alone been successful on Survivor. Now, I will say Nick's move, he had a whole deck of information, but I was listening to a lot of the postseason interviews from all the different players that you did to sort of see if I could put together a three-dimensional picture of what it was like to be there, so I could have a better understanding of what exactly went down, because the edited episode only gives you so much. And they actually didn't even give Nick really any credit in the episode itself. There's a secret scene where they give him all the credit. And I love that. But Nick was the guy who was really instrumental in this move, because he was the David where all the Goliaths approached him and wanted to make sure that he was in the loop, that they, that he knew Angelina wasn't the vote that night. Angelina was the decoy boot for the Davids to accidentally vote for. But in truth, it was Christian who was going to get voted out. And the Goliaths weren't splitting the vote. They weren't doing anything else. They were going to all go, all seven of them, on Christian. And they told only David. A lot of them told David. I think Mike, I think Allison, and
they told Nick
about this. Nobody else. So Nick has this information, and he's like, gosh, I don't know if I want Christian to go. He knows he has a still a vote advantage, and he can utilize that to make it a 6-6 possible tie. But he goes to Davey right after, and he says, look, Davey, this is what they're doing. They're not voting out Angelina. This is going to come down to the Goliaths are going to send, they're going to blast Christian out of the game, all seven votes. Mm-hmm. They can't split the vote because they don't have the numbers to do it. So in the event that, you know, there's an idol or something, so they're not going to split it. They're going to go all straight on Christian. Davey then says, well, guess what? I got an idol. He whips out his idol. He's like, look, I got an idol to play. And like, oh, snap. So then Nick says, well, this is what we have to do. And he says, we have to split our votes between the three of us. And he chooses, he and Davey, I don't know to what degree the conversation went down with, but it did sound like it was a little bit more on Nick's side. They split the vote. And if Dave is listening, I'm so sorry, Davey, if I'm not giving you the credit you deserve, because you definitely did a lot here too. Playing the idol for the first place was amazing. One of my favorite moments in the season and in all of Survivor. But they decide to leave out Carl and Gabby from the vote just to say, you know what? We don't need more people knowing anything. Let them vote for Angelina. Let them play dumb. Let all of them play dumb. All the Davids are going to play dumb and think that they're going to vote for Angelina and everything's going to be honky-dory. But in truth, Nick and Davey, and they informed Christian, which we did see in the episode, we're going to vote for one of the Goliaths. It was either going to be John or Kara. They were the two that they trusted the least. And they wanted to vote for Dan, but he won the immunity. Mm-hmm. So it was just this moment in the show where we saw a minority alliance split their vote to counter a majority idol that I was very impressed by. And it largely was because of Nick being considered trustworthy, his good old Southern boy, Southern country charm accent. He puts this plan into motion and it works out in spades, and he gets the credit, and everyone comes back to camp in the secret scene. And they're like, Nick's just like so beaming, and they're like, Nick, you are so brilliant. And I'm like, man, how did Nick not become a bigger target at that point? Mm-hmm. But so what do you think in regards to this? Is this not that ingenious? Is it okay?
It was a really great move by a group of people. And I think that what was so powerful about the Davids, when it was they really got on a roll, because there was a lot of information sharing that was going on. And the group was at one point very tight, and they knew where the advantages were, they knew where the votes were going, and they were able to be this very cohesive unit moving forward. And, you know, knowledge was power for Nick, and that his demeanor was one where a lot of people felt comfortable. Probably they underestimated him and they felt comfortable sharing information with him very quickly. Like, Alec had known him for what, like a couple of days in the game, and was telling him about.
And Alec was the one who told him that the vote was on Christian.
Yeah. And also, Nick was like not like unencumbered by the like, oh, I have to stay, you know, I have to like stay loyal to, you know, people like Mike and people like Alec, and was able to act on that information. He knew that this was going to be the only opportunity. So, yeah, very, very good one for Nick Wilson. And I think one that sort of gets overshadowed by the move that I had mentioned with the that he uses his vote and steals Allison, and then the Idol Nullifier gets played. And are those back to back episodes?
Yeah, they are. It's a little messy.
It's a little messy right there at like 12, 11.
Yeah, like the details. I just know it's like this is where it gets really exciting for a couple episodes.
It gets really excited. And then I think that we have the, and then we have like the double episode, and then Carl gets voted out, and then everything goes crazy.
Right.
But right, I thought that you were maybe going to say that when Gabby gets voted out was going to be the move where they end up then. When Gabby wants to come after Christian, that he turns it around, and then they're able to put the votes on Gabby at that tribal council because Christian plays. Does Christian play his idol? Is that what happens?
Yeah, he did play his idol. He played his idol and negated like the majority of the
Gabby
votes.
Gabby wanted to blindside him with an idol, and then they were able to. I don't know if they gave Christian the heads up. This is a little, I know I did a million interviews about this that season, but
yeah, that's one thing I didn't go too far ahead to look at.
Yeah, but that was but I think that was Nick's move also of like, hey, why don't we put the votes on Gabby and get Gabby voted out?
Yeah, the vote ended up being 5-2-1. So Christian did play his idol. And he negated the 5 votes. And then the 2 votes were from Mike and Angelina for Gabby. And then Christian voted for Allison out of the blue. So, yeah, I didn't put that down. But that was definitely, I think it was also something that Nick had put together.
And they got rid of Gabby. And they got rid of Christian's idol in one vote.
Right. Another great move. Yeah. And, you know, that's also something that could be brought up. And I think that Nick gets a little underrated in general, even though his season was pretty fresh in a lot of people's minds, maybe because he just wasn't the biggest character on the season and he gets a little bit overshadowed. Also, maybe they didn't give him the credit in the episode itself for some of these moves. It was more of a group effort. But when you really dig into the weeds and the details of it, you know, Nick was doing a lot more than I think people let on. And yeah, that's another move that, you know, in another universe, I could have put on this list and I overlooked it. So, but it was
a lot of stuff going on. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Two more.
Number 9 on this list is another recent from the 30s. It is a winner who we have referenced already in this podcast from Survivor Game Changers. We have Sarah Lacina.
Sarah Lacina back on the list. Okay. I know you talked about her giving the advantage to Suri.
Yes, at the final 7.
So was this the legacy advantage?
Yes, it was.
For Sierra Dawn Thomas.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, fan favorite game changer, yes, Sierra Dawn Thomas. You know, at the final 9 of Game Changers, she has this legacy advantage that she got on episode 1 on minute 1. And she is down and out. She was just blindsided from the Zeke vote at the final 10. And she's looking for friends. And she approaches Sarah at the beginning of the episode. And she's like, look, I got this advantage. And I need an inroad. Like, I need an ally. Somebody like, this is me, like, opening up and showing you that I have something that's really valuable and I want you to know about it, you know, so to make a friend, to create a bond, to show that I have trust, almost similar to what Sarah does to an extent in giving away stuff to sort of create these bonds of trust. And there's a good little timeline with Sarah's story here at the final 9 that you are probably privy to as well. Like how at the beginning of the episode, she was actually not interested in voting out Sierra. She was thinking about keeping Sierra because of Sierra's move. Sierra was, you know, opening up to her, being a potential ally for Sarah. And Sarah was like, oh, okay. Yeah, you know, let's do this. Let's roll. Interesting to note, I was just listening to Aubrey talk, and she brought up Sierra as well. And I was listening to her Game Changers postseason podcast, and she actually said that Sierra is really a really threatening player that you wouldn't really mm-hmm. notice from the episodes. Yeah. She said that she reminded her of Kim Spradlin, actually.
Well, both of them are very tall. I wonder if that's true. Like, it's very hard to miss Ciara Dawn Thomas. So I can see why, like, in person, she might be imposing, but as a viewer, you don't see a lot of her.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly didn't get the vibe, but yeah, they certainly do have a similar stature. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, Sarah was interested in keeping Ciara at this point in the episode. And it's only once Brad is the target in the episode. Brad wins the immunity challenge. And Sarah is remiss about this. She wanted to vote out Brad at this point. So they're like, okay, the focus shifted to Ciara now. And Sarah went, this was the loved one's mm-hmm. visit episode. Yeah. And she did get her loved one to come back. And she got to spend time with him. I think it was her husband. Yes. I don't remember exactly what his name was, but I do know that he played a part mm-hmm. in this. And Sarah had admitted that she and him had talked about this and she wasn't sure what she wanted to do. She said that, you know, Sarah has this advantage and she disclosed it to Sarah. And Sarah wasn't sure if she should keep Sarah on her side and keep the advantage with Ciara, or blindside Ciara and vote her out because Brad was, I don't think Brad had won immunity at this point, but she was like, do I take out Brad or not? Or do I take out Ciara or not and procure the advantage to myself? She said she would give it to her. And I think her husband or her loved one, it was her husband, said, like, yeah, well, you should do this. Like, this is what you should do. And she was like, yeah, I agree. She sort of pushed, she was on the fence, and I think her husband mm-hmm. helped her make the yeah. decision. So,
yeah, what do I care about Ciara Dawn Thomas?
Right. Like, you know, the legacy advantage proved to be one of the greatest things for Sarah's game in the end. What does she care if Ciara has it? Like, give it to her, you know? Mm-hmm. Sarah was in such a great position anyway, being in the middle between these two alliances, that I think she absolutely made the right call here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a big moment in the show. Never tell anybody that you are going to give them something if you get voted out, because survivors are very self-interested. I think that this ultimately has a lot of ramifications, including jackets, where people are saying, like, hey, will you will your jacket to me after if you get voted out?
Exactly. Yeah, I do think that this move was quite defining. It's a move that has been brought up again in future seasons, and it's something that I think has stuck for not only Sarah's game as a winner, but for, like, the history of Survivor strategy, at least as far as the advantages go. You don't tell people you have it. We saw it even brought up in the latest season with Ron and Aurora. Mm-hmm. Aurora gives Ron the advantage, and he's like, oh, do I pull a Sarah here? Do I vote her, mm-hmm. vote Aurora off and keep it to myself? And I remember I was listening again to his interview that you had yeah. with him, and he said he regretted it. He regretted not pulling a Sarah here.
Because ultimately that extra vote gets used against him.
Right. Obviously, you know, it's hindsight. You said it's 2020. So what are you going to do? Maybe if it had worked out, it wouldn't be the same mm-hmm. regret, but right. I think that managing, you know, these advantages as they come to you is so crucial. And I think you see on one hand, you have one side of the coin, you have Sarah who is, you know, given the knowledge of an advantage. And she's like, look, if I get voted out, you get it. And then in the case of Ron, he doesn't vote. He doesn't pull the Sarah here. He pulls the good cop to Sarah's bad cop. And I don't want to get too results oriented thinking, but I do think that having the advantage, especially now with we're all the way in 38, is way more important to have it on your side and to know where it's going to be and how it's going to get used. Or he ends up getting
and just to build on that in one of the interviews that I've done with Boston Rob and talking about the hidden immunity idol, and Rob, you know, likes to have the hidden immunity idol, but he doesn't necessarily want to play it because he says, you know, the advantage is that you know that you have it and somebody else doesn't. And so, you know, just knowing that, okay, this advantage is in my pocket. It's not in somebody else's. It's not recirculated. And you can, you know, rest a little easier, one less thing to worry about.
Right. Exactly. And he didn't, like, at the beginning of Heroes versus Villains, Rob tried to ignore the idol, and he's like, you know, whoever goes after that, we're just going to vote him out.
Yeah.
But it's like, well, if they have the idol...
And that's one of the things. I don't know how you feel about Survivor 39 in terms of the Rob and Sandra, but I feel like that will be interesting to, you know, have the opinions of, you know, Rob and Sandra sort of disseminated, because that I don't know if Rob and Sandra are necessarily, well, Sandra played in Game Changers, but, you know, Rob has sort of like that mentality of like, you know, don't play the idols, hold on to the advantages, and isn't pushing necessarily for big moves. And I wonder, even though his style of gameplay was unpopular in season 22, but I wonder if that could be something that is, if people feel like the game is too fast and it's too crazy, then maybe that might be a little bit of something that slows the track down.
Yeah, you know, I thought about it. It's, you know, Rob and Sandra, obviously, they fit the theme that they're going for really, really well. I don't know how well they're going to fit the pacing of season 39 or what it'll bring compared to, like, you know, the 30s have been a whole new caliber of Survivor, I feel like, looking back now that we have 7 or 8 seasons under our belt. And Rob is a very much an old school player. He's more about the manipulative, psychological, you know, slow and steady and just keep everyone bunkered down. He likes to just sort of have an us versus them mentality where, you know, it's one versus the other, black and white. That's how he's played the game. It's like my alliance, my tribe, and you just bulldoze the other side. There's no flipping and flopping. There's no idols and craziness. He's very much like an antithesis to what modern Survivor is, where Rob wants to keep everything tucked away. Don't get pretty. Yeah. Don't get showy. Just stick to your buddy. Mm-hmm. And everything will be okay. And in this case, as modern Survivor, we saw with season 38, for example, it was just all over the place. People were just flipping around everywhere, and advantages were left and right. We had like 9 idols, I think, in the whole season, which might be a record. And, you know, Sandra did play Game Changers. So I'm not sure how their mechanic in 39 is going to even work, how it's going to exactly play itself into the game of Survivor, because I was sort of speculating on how Ghost Island would have played into Survivor. How is it's just like another expansion to the game that works really well, but will it be manipulated and affected a lot by whatever it is that Rob and Sandra are doing? I'm not sure. You know, I'll be curious to know what they want to do with it. Are they just imparting wisdom? Because I don't know. Is that worthy of them being on the island for 39 days when they're not even playing?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Rob's whole game is like loss prevention, where, you know, and I don't mean that he doesn't take risks, because that
no, he does.
Other than voting out Hunter Ellis, that he's, you know, every other time, every other game, he is part of like the bigger alliance that's controlling things. And, you know, Russell screwed things up with Parvati and Danielle in Heroes versus Villains. But,
yeah,
you know,
his, Tyson,
his
yeah.
game is about, you know, playing with the lead and then keeping anything crazy from happening. And
right. He's all about everyone staying on rails and just going
and
to
and
the
Survivor
end.
Right now is about making sure every week something crazy happens. So it might be very counterintuitive for the show to have brought his presence in for season 39.
Yeah, they should have just put put War Dog on him.
Yeah, I mean, he'd be telling people to do something crazy every single round. Where
right, just have a giant idol of War Dog.
You know, Rob is going to be telling people like how to squeeze the air out of the ball and slow things down.
Right. This is how you suffocate the other tribe to the point where they just don't want to do anything and they're terrible TV.
Right.
You guys get all the airtime. Yeah. You get all the funny quotes. Yeah, I know. It'll be
pretty. You did a really great job breaking down the Boston Rob strategy in one of the earlier parts of this series, talking about the buddy system and everything that Rob did in season 22.
Yeah, that was another ingenious move. I wanted to give him kudos. Not that he already doesn't get enough, but I thought it was definitely something different that you don't see on Survivor ever. Especially, he was just so in command. And I mean, some people would argue that he was put on a tribe that wanted to listen to him, but at the same time, he managed to take his position and his advantage and his experience and just masterfully do something that was, in my opinion, very ingenious. That we have not really seen replicated to that degree, or maybe at all, even now that I think about it. The buddy system was definitely, it was Rob at like his peak as far as strategy goes.
Okay. We've got one move left, one ingenious winner move left to talk about. What is it? Where are we going?
This is a move that I very much enjoy. I think the fans love it. It was one of the most requested moves when I brought this up. I asked people, what do you guys think should be on this? And this was definitely, I would say this was the number one most requested one. this was done by Natalie Anderson on Survivor San Juan del Sur. Now, in part two, I brought up another move of hers where she played her idol on Jacqueline at the Final Five. And that one was actually more on the bubble than this one.
Okay.
I'm curious to know, and I think you'll know what this one is, but what do you think this move
is?
Is
this when she voted for Alec Christie instead of Keith Nail?
Okay. It is. That's the 20th move of 20 on the Most Ingenious Moves.
I liked your idea for that $5 investment.
You did.
I thought that was a good call.
Pro Natalie. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think Natalie is a good, she's a good winner. And I think on some level, she's not underrated by the super fans, but I do think on general by the casual audience, you don't hear Natalie being brought up as like the pinnacle or at the top. She's comfortably in a position where I really like what she's able to do on her season. She does a masterful job. I was rewatching it, the post-merge to get, you know, prepared to talk about it and to also like understand the move and the ingenuity of it between the Final Five and the Final Seven, what she does here. She is like, as Jeremy said, she is a baller. She got it and she deserved it. And I'm happy to give her kudos for this move at the Final Seven.
She's really fun. She is incredibly strong. I think that she might be, I don't think that this is hyperbole to say that she might be I guess it would depend on what the event was, but in terms of like a strong women that are on Survivor, I think she might be. I mean, that if you watch her social media, she does CrossFit like constantly and is always like eating the right foods. I mean, she is in incredible shape.
Wasn't she going to be on like Game Changers?
She was going to be on Game Changers. Yeah. And I'm not exactly sure if that, I think that she might have had, I'm not sure if it was both things or one of the two things that I think that she was, she got injured where she had a brain injury where I think that there was like a, I'm not a doctor, but I think there was some concern for CTE. Where she got injured, lifting weights, I believe. And then I'm not sure also, I think that there was also a spider bit her also. I think that, and I'm not sure exactly which of those two things. I'm speaking a little bit out of school, but she was going to be a game changer.
Okay. Well, I could see her, you know, I think she would have fit the bill really well as a game changer. I think that she's comfortably where she's not underrated, but she's definitely at the cream. She's a cream of the crop winner, in my opinion. She does a really great job. The post-merge of San Juan del Sur really outlines how great of a player she is. I also think it is, you know, if you want to talk about Survivor poetry, the fact that her sister goes out first, she goes on to win the season, and she does it in spectacular fashion.
Identical
is
twins.
Just really great.
One is the first one out, and one is the winner.
And I hadn't seen The Amazing Race, actually. I hadn't seen her on The Amazing Race at that time. I was still catching up with my wife casually watching it. So I didn't know her yet at the time, but seeing her on The Amazing Race was a much different experience here. It's a totally different show and different game, but I really enjoyed her on San Juan del Sur. And I would have loved to have seen her on Game Changers as well. I think she could have done a lot of damage.
But let's talk about this specific move.
Right. So for those who don't remember, this was at the Final Seven of San Juan del Sur. Natalie is in a strong alliance of five. I think they jokingly said they were the Fab Five of herself, John, Jacqueline, Missy, and Baylor. So she's the fifth wheel of this two duo, five-person alliance of boyfriend, girlfriend, and mother-daughter. And the idea was they were going to split the votes between Keith and Alec, who were the two outsiders, in the event that maybe Keith or Alec had an idol, which Keith did play an idol earlier in the season. Maybe there was another one in play. They're like, you know what? It can't hurt. It's the easy thing to do. There's only two of them. So the idea was John and Jacqueline and Natalie were going to put their votes on Keith, and Missy and Bailey were going to put their votes on Alec. And Natalie didn't want Alec to stay because he was more aligned with maybe the John and Jacqueline of the duo. And Natalie's post-merge story arc was very hellbent on getting John out once John blindsided her number one ally, Jeremy, who was supposed to be good with everyone. And then all of a sudden this fast one was pulled on Natalie and she didn't forget. She didn't forgive and she didn't forget. She did forgive, but she definitely didn't forget. And Natalie spends the episode really laying in, trying to set up the pieces to knock John out at this point. She gets Baylor on her side, who is very convinced that John needs to go as well, thanks to Natalie. And then John goes and wins immunity. He is immune. And it's odd. Natalie is so depressed. She's just bemoaning. She's like, this was going to be my big move. Like, I, you know, the jury wants to see big moves. And she brings this up in the episode. I thought it was interesting to see from 10 seasons ago, we have this, you know, I know big moves were just becoming a lot more prominent in the rhetoric of Survivor. And here we have Natalie, the winner, who's like, I really wanted to make this big move for my resume because the jury loves that.
Kagyan, I think that season filmed like within like a week or two from the ending of Kagyan.
And it just goes to show, you know, Tony has a big splash, and here we have Natalie. She's feeling the effect of Tony.
Yeah.
And so,
I love both of them. And this, I mean, 2014 was such a great year for Survivor.
It really was. I'm looking back. It's hard to always appreciate it.
And people didn't like San Juan del Sur in the pre-merge. People were like, why are they bringing back why they bring back this format of blood versus water with, you know, we don't know who these new people are, but it gave us, you know, a lot of big characters, Jeremy and Kelly Wentworth and Natalie Anderson and Keith Nail all come out of that season. Yeah. And it's such a great post-merge.
It's a really good post-merge. I was actually not feeling the pre-merge at the time. I was actually kind of frustrated with the pre-merge, and I just wasn't that interested in it. But yeah, things really turned around. For me, I was at the beginning not feeling the season, especially after Kagyan, which had such a dynamic cast and such an explosive ping-ponging with Tony and Spencer and Wu and everyone. There's a lot of great characters. And then for me, San Juan del Sur felt like it slowed down a little bit. But the post-merge, in my opinion, it's one of the best post-merges in all of Survivor. And it's largely thanks to Natalie and like her story arc, especially at this point on in the season. She really just dominates the end game and creates just this constant feathers in her cap for what she ultimately is able to cash in on at the final.
And this move that you're talking about with voting for Alec instead of Keith, it came, I believe it was at the end of a double episode. And I remember doing the know-it-alls that night, and we're like, okay, well, what's like, okay, big deal. So why, you know, why did Natalie do this? We were sort of like, okay, well, this is just like, you know, deck chairs on the Titanic, you know, how is she gonna, she wants to get John out. I'm not really sure what this accomplishes, and now everybody's going to be mad at her. But the next episode, she's just like, oh, I voted for I thought I was supposed to vote for Alec. Oh, you know, and they're like, oh, you're crazy. Oh, come on. All right. No big deal.
They're like, oh, you know, it happens. It's okay. We'll get him next time. Like, it's not like, you know, yeah, I was interested. Like, well, I love about that post scene at the beginning of the next episode. Like, Jacqueline is like, did Alec vote for himself? Like, what
that
happened?
That would be the most like, Christie brother thing to ever happen.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that would even be considered as like that's the leading theory at the moment. What happened? Alec goes home. Alec voted for himself. Yeah, but then Natalie is like, yeah, you know, she's what I loved about this move was like not only did she had the cojones to pull it off, but she has to sell it sort of like how Sarah with her vote out, she had to pretend to be really confused when Sarah was on the way out. Natalie had to pretend to be completely normal because she was under the impression, the fake impression, that voting out Alec was the right idea, right? That was her story. Her story was, I made the right idea. So I rewatched that moment, and Natalie's a little timid because she knows what's happening, but she's fairly like, not like, oh my God, like what happened? She's actually playing it up like, this was the plan. The plan was to vote out Alec, and I didn't make a mistake. So when she goes back to camp, everyone is all of a sudden really confused. And then she's like, oh, okay. So she begins to keep the narrative alive from like the beginning, the moment she decides to pull the trigger to the moment, you know, it's just an Academy Award winning, as far as Survivor goes, a daytime Emmy Award winning performance from Natalie, where she just, and she really convinces John and Jacqueline and maybe Missy. I know Baylor was in on the idea. She was laughing that they all bought it. But it really, it paved the way for Natalie to pull a fast one, not just in voting John out in the next episode, but to set the stage, per se, to vote John out. Because if John had suspected anything here of any foul play from Natalie, that might not have, John might not go maybe, or who knows what happens, like something could change. But he was very, very, he downplayed it and forgave it and was like, no big deal. Like, we make mistakes. We'll just make sure the next time everyone's on the same page. It's like, well, actually the truth is nobody was on the same page because Natalie was out playing all of you guys. And that was the point of it.
And the move to get John Mish out, I think, is also a good one too, right? Isn't that she sets up a 2-2-2 vote split at the final six.
Yeah, partially reaping the fruits of her move from the final seven, keeping Keith on her side and being able to utilize Keith, who was just like, I want John out bad. Like, Keith wanted him out. Baylor wanted him out and she wanted him out. So she already got three, just had to get Missy on board, which they managed to do. Yeah, like Natalie keeping Keith around and then ultimately splitting the vote 2-2-2 on John and Jacqueline ensured that John was going out no matter what, unless he won immunity again. So it's just like she plays it really well at this point, and then she just continues to play it well from episode by episode until the end. And it really does start here with this move. So for me, it was sort of a shoo-in as far as the ingenuity goes of Natalie just really going outside the box, putting on a great performance, snowing John really well and Jacqueline, and just taking it home.
Well, Pridium, this was so much fun to go through all of these Survivor moments with you.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been a longtime fan of Rev as a podcast. I didn't mention this earlier. I mean, you probably understood based on what I've talked about. But I was there from February.
Oh, wow. I didn't
know that. When you first started. Yeah. So I got into Survivor with Token Jeans and I became a really big fan leading up to Heroes versus Villains. And then I remember being in a small Survivor community and somebody was like, Rob C started a podcast. And I was like, is there a link out? I was like, oh, okay, cool. And I started listening from the ground floor from day zero.
Wow.
And it's just, yeah, I've been there the whole time. So my Survivor journey as a fan, as a super fan, to where I am now as, you know, a content creator did start along with having your thoughts in my head every season. So to say that you've affected me a lot is
I really appreciate that. And I have a lot of admiration for what you do because I think that, you know, I think it's a nice companion because, that you're able to, you know, look at specific things and be so visual where, you know, what I do is, you know, all audio for the most part. And it's right. Just really, really fun to go through. And you start watching one of these videos and then, the next one comes on and they just keep playing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, thanks. That was the idea going into it. And a lot of the information that I've gathered to like fact check what I'm talking about comes from you.
Oh, well, double fact check stuff from me.
Well, I mean, I try to take some of it with a grain of salt, but I do like to consider it, just for the sake of it. But I do go back and I look at, you know, I have quotes because I've been listening for so long. There are quotes in my head that I'm going to one day pull out that I remember from a podcast from 5 years ago from somebody saying it. I was like, I remember that line and I loved it and I want to bring it up because it's relevant in this next topic. I've quoted you in the past in videos and I will continue to do so because...
Oh, I appreciate that. Do you take requests for videos?
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. Every week. So even when I'm not taking requests, I get requests.
I don't have one. I'm just saying, but if it ever comes up that I feel like that, this is a good idea for a Pridium video. If I think of one.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, if you ever think of anything, feel free to shoot me a message. Yeah, I have I have a master list of ideas and, you know, fans send me ideas all the time and I just, you know, I'll add it to the queue. And if it's relevant to what's happening in the modern season or I'm just really interested in talking about it, I will. Yeah.
I also like at the end of the season where you do like a review of the season.
Oh, yeah, I like sort of sitting back and encapsulating my experience in sort of contextualizing it because I might change over the years, but I can always go back to like how I felt at that time in the period of the show's history and just be like, this is what I felt about it then. Do I feel about it the same way now? And sort of recapping the events over the last 3 months because it's such a roller coaster. I know what it's like to be a fan of the show and to sit down for 3 months straight. And so I like to sort of just go over with a fine tooth comb and assess everything on a big picture.
And two more questions. What is your most popular video that you've ever done?
The most popular one isn't like the most views that it has. the most views, I believe, last I checked. So it's, I haven't checked lately.
Top
I
think sexiest it might ladies be... of Survivor.
Yeah, right. That was a beta drafted idea that I actually had on a list before I ever
made my first
video.
I don't know why. This one has like 10 times as many views.
Yeah, that would actually be up there if I made it. I think it's the one with Purple Kelly on it.
Oh,
it might be the one where I talk
milk
about
your milk. Is that what it is? Yeah,
it might be where I talk about the purple edit. It's either that or the first mm-hmm. one I ever made. Yeah, that was an interesting mm-hmm. one. I've had my family members who don't watch my wife doesn't watch my channel. She's just like, I don't want to talk about Survivor all the time in the first place. I've had family members. It's the loved ones visit one. That's the most popular.
Okay. Wow. What is that?
I just checked now. That's the most entertaining loved ones visits in Survivor. And it's got Fairplay and Thunder D with, She Died Dude.
Yeah.
On the thumbnail.
Yeah. Yeah, great work on the thumbnails too. And then finally, would you ever participate in a Survivor season? Well, are you ever interested in applying for Survivor? Because I think that for the most part, people don't know what you look like. That if you showed up on the beach, I think that nobody would necessarily know you were you, even if they were a super fan, unless they recognized your voice. Have you ever thought about applying for the show?
Yeah, maybe that's the strategy. Don't go on camera in the event that I ever were on Survivor. People wouldn't know who I am. Yeah, I would. And I would do it in a heartbeat. I would love to go on Survivor. It was a dream of mine, you know, before I ever made the channel. And I'm not really utilizing the channel to get on Survivor, but if it helps, it helps. If it hurts, it hurts. But I would totally do it.
Okay.
Totally do it.
All right.
Or Big Brother. I would
do
Big Brother.
If we see the no videos for like 6 or 7 weeks, then...
You know, I thought about that. If I ever was, I was like, what would I do? I think I would actually try and blitz and make like 2 or 3 months of videos just to fake everyone out.
Yeah.
I don't know. But that would be a dream.
All right. Peridium, thank you so much. We want to give out your social media. We know the YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube is Peridium. Twitter is, you could search for Peridium. It's also my real name is my handle. It's Billy Geis. I would just search for Peridium to find it. But that's pretty much it. I do have Instagram, but I don't really use it very often.
All right. So Peridium, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate getting to talk this through and looking forward to some more great videos.
Thank you so much for having me. The amount of times that I've thought about finally getting to talk to you, and it, obviously I don't know what would have gotten me to talk to you, but I just want to say thank you for giving me the opportunity to sit down and talk and chat. Obviously, I've been a fan for a while. It does mean a lot and blow my mind to some extent. So I appreciate spending the last couple hours here sitting down talking about
it. It was a lot of fun.
Shows.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, there you have it. The great Peridium talking about the ingenious moves made by the Survivor winners. Of course, that's just part 3 that we talked about. I highly recommend you check out parts 1 and 2 on Peridium's YouTube channel and give him a subscription as well to keep up with everything that he's doing. If you enjoy hearing some of these moments that we've talked about here today and much, much more, I also recommend you check out our Evolution of Strategy audiobook, 300 hours of Josh Wigler and I breaking down every single move that happened in Survivor between season 1 and season 30. Of course, chapter 1, all about Borneo, is completely for free. A 5-hour audiobook available to you when you go ahead and check it out at evolutionofstrategy.com or check out the sidebar of robhasawebsite.com. Oh, thank you so much for listening to the podcast today. Hope we can do some more stuff with Peridium in the future. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. Bye. This episode of Rob is a Podcast is sponsored by our friends over at True Car. Every car comes with its share of stories, like that ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, that luxury package you got after a big promotion, or the mileage you save by riding your bike all summer long. Now, while you can't put a price tag on your stories now with True Car, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell it or to trade it in. Just go to True Car and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details just pop up. Then answer a few questions, navigation and moonroof. Watch as they bump up your car's value. High mileage, you already knew it was going to cost you, but now you'll know how much it's going to ding your wallet so you can plan ahead. And once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or to trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out True Car today. True cash offer not available in all areas.